Coming up on Chasing the Natty, we talk all the time about the quarterbacks, the running backs, the wide receivers, and every once in a while, the tight ends. But as we all know, those positions are not the only pieces of a football team, and today we're going to talk about some of the forgotten factors of college football teams that could impact your favorite CFF players this season. Which of your running backs could be impaired by a weaker O-line? Who will have less scoring opportunities due to their team's defense improving? We've got all that and more coming right after this.
Look at Ginty go! Breaks a tackle! He's 10! He's touchdown! Cook's gonna throw the deep ball, and Burton cracked the defense! Touchdown, Luther Burton!
Milroe gonna run it again, got a lane! Kicked in the turbo, Milroe! Goodbye! Touchdown, Bama!
This is Chasing the Natty, a college fantasy football podcast. All right, welcome in everyone. This is Jared Palmgren, host of the Chasing the Natty podcast. I hope you guys are having a wonderful ride to your work on this Monday morning. We are the College Fantasy Football Podcast on the Campus of Canton Podcast Network. You can find us on all of your podcast feeds and on YouTube every Monday morning during the off season at 6 a.m. sharp. If you want to support the great work we're doing here, head on over to campusofcanton.com and subscribe there with one of our astonishing tiers. We have content ranging on all sorts of college fantasy football games, whether it's college fantasy football, redraft, Devy, Campus of Canton Leagues, college IDP, college DFS. Really, if you play it, we've got content, whether that's tools, rankings, pretty much everything you need to succeed. If you want to get in touch for whatever reason, you can find me and the show on Twitter. I'm at CFF underscore Jared. The show is at Chasing the Natty, and the handsome fellow joining me this week is owner of CFBWinningEdge.com, at CFBWinningEdge on Twitter, and captain of our C2C Winning Edge package here at Campus of Canton, Mr. Nicholas Ian Allen. Nick, you've been hard at work these last couple of weeks, man, but how you doing?
Good. It's always a bit of a relief to put a new project out into the world. So you're catching me on a good day.
Absolutely, man. So let's, I guess, jump right on into it, man. What have you been working on? What did you release today? As we're recording this, you've released it today. But by the time Monday rolls around, it'll have been out for a couple of days now. What is the 2024 team profiles that you've released?
So when I started CFP Winning Edge prior to the 2018 season, the first thing, really all it was at that point, were these Google Sheets that are, you know, individual team pages that give projected depth charts and player ratings, power ratings, all that good stuff to help project, point spreads and who would be favored against who in matchups and, on a neutral field if you were trying to look into the future on potential future opponents, all that good stuff. And they've grown and changed quite a bit since then, but they're basically the biggest piece of work that I do on an annual basis, and it's basically just throwing as much player information and team information, coach information into one source as possible. Like, I've literally ran out of space. Google Sheets has said, you know, you've reached your maximum amount of cells, and gives us a lot to use, and we'll talk about some of the maybe unique ways that we can use the information that we've put together. But it's basically, you know, every team's roster, player information from recruiting info, experience, production, throw that into some coaching metrics, throw that into some stats, and we just spit out a bunch of projections for team matchups and things like that. But it also gives a really solid picture of what do these teams look like on paper, how talented are they, where are some spots where Position by position, who's strong, who's weak, where are areas to improve? If a injury hits, what area has the less least amount of depth, things like that. So basically, I just wanted to put as much information as I would use on a day-to-day basis for college football work all into one place, and that's our team profiles.
It is an incredible piece of, again, like it's hard to just call it work or any like one sheet. It's just a massive, massive database that pretty much so many of you guys ask me, like, you guys have projected depth charts. Do you guys have, or do you guys like have, different projections of like how strong different positions are on different teams and everything? That's this. That is exactly what this is. And we pretty much do outsource a lot of this here because, Nick, you're absolutely incredible in the amount of time that you're able to put into this. The amount of research that you put into this is pretty much second to none. I know for a fact that in previous years, you have outperformed when it came to, spreads and stuff like that against some of the big names in the industry. And so, again, your hard work pays off. It really is, in my opinion, probably the biggest bang for your buck you can get in terms of a one place to go to get the information that you guys are looking for. Again, as Nick mentioned, we'll kind of touch on some of the more unique things you can do with this database today and how it can apply to CFF. But if you're just looking for some surface level stuff in terms of CFF stuff, again, like Nick mentioned, the depth charts are huge. Because Nick doesn't just list the top one or two guys. Pretty much every single player that is in that wide receiver room that you're thinking about or that running back room is listed there. And Nick has them projected out in terms of what order he thinks that they are in. Again, sometimes it's numerical based. Sometimes it's based on what we have in experience. So it's a phenomenal, phenomenal piece of data that every single one of you absolutely should go and get. And I don't just say that because it is part of our family here at Campus of Canton, but it is. I was subscribed to Nick before he became part of our team here at Campus of Canton because of how incredible his work has been. And you've only gotten better over the years, Nick. It is, if I remember correctly, this is actually the earliest you've been able to put them out, is it?
I think so. Things have changed a little bit over the years. For a while, the team profiles would come before the returning production database this year, and with the move to Campus Canton, that was huge to get some, extra help and some people much smarter than me to make things a little more efficient as far as putting that returning production database together. And so, because we were able to do that much quicker, that opened up a little more time for the team profile. So they're out early. I'm not sure it's the earliest it's ever been, because there was a time where that was the only thing it did. There were years where there wasn't a returning production database, but also there were years where the order was flipped and made a change, I think, for the better on that part. But so it's earlier than last year. It's earlier than the last couple of years. But also, it's basically, as soon as it is not embarrassingly awful in my eyes, I release it. So this is not a perfect document. I think it's good. It's usable. It's already maybe the best version we've put together. But this on release day is the worst it will be. We'll continue to, you mentioned look at all the wide receivers. I mean, literally every wide receiver on the roster. Like,
Every
I go
single one.
through, if it's a walk-on, make sure there's a name there just in case, because sometimes those guys will pop up and do something in a game, and I'll just have to adjust to it because they get updated not only between now and the season kicking off, they get updated daily, hourly during the season. So as games are happening, the things change, the ratings change for players, for teams, all that good stuff. So I use the off season to put as much information in there as possible, publish it once that, it's set up in a usable format, because before anybody else's eyes see it, I mean, this thing is it's pretty scary looking on
Oh, yeah.
my end for a little while. But once I clean it up to the point where I'm just not completely embarrassed to put it out there, try to give our folks as much time to use it as possible, but it continues to get updated hourly, daily, between now and the 2025 team profiles. Like I still have the 2023 team profiles tab open on my computer because it's still useful for building the 2024 one. But anyway, yeah, it is going to get better and better each day between now and when the season starts, and then it only gets better from there, adjusting to stuff in season as well.
No, for sure. And again, that live updating that Nick does for pretty much daily on it. I know, Nick, you're out for the next week or so. There won't be any major changes in the first week here, but as soon as you get back and everything, you pretty much make daily updates to this thing every, wow, make daily updates every single day. Great work, Jared. You're a true artist with your words there. Anyway, so many of you will DM me and talk to me about how like it's so hard to keep up with everything. And yeah, I completely agree. Like there's so many things that fly under the radar. I don't know if there's anything that gets past Nick. Nick, you're absolutely incredible in the way that you're able to pick up on the smallest bits of news is here and there. So enough of the fluffing. Let's go talk about unique ways that we can actually use these team profiles. And this is something that I am really think that, if you're somebody who wants to get into like content creation and stuff like that, it's all about like finding those niches and everything like that. I think one area in which I think could make really interesting content in the future is how do these position groups that we don't really think about in fantasy too often impact your favorite fantasy players? And specifically, again, we're going to talk about two main groups today. One, the offensive lines, and then two, the just defensive performance, right? Talking about like how good is your defense? Because the theory goes that like obviously with O-line, right? Like people say it all the time. Football's won in the trenches, right? If you don't have a strong O-line, you're not going to win. And so if a team suddenly goes from having a strong O-line to a much weaker O-line the next year, how does that impact players on that roster? Look at Shedeur Sanders last year, right? Like he could have been an absolute fantasy just dynamite the entire year, except for the fact that he kept getting sacked every other play, and eventually he got him hurt, right? Now, again, we're not going to sit here and say like, oh, don't draft Avery Johnson because Kansas State's O-line's going to get him hurt. No, that's not what we're going to do here today. But it's something to it like looking at those O-lines and how they change from year to year that can impact. The other side of it is just the defense, right? Theory goes. If your defense forces you to score, you're going to have more scoring opportunities because you have to in order to win the game. Versus if you have a stronger defense than you've had in the past, maybe you don't get that extra 2 to 3 touchdown opportunities that you would normally get each week. So that's kind of where we're going to go today. Again, we got groups that have some weaker O-lines, some stronger O-lines than last year, improved defenses, worse defenses. But Nick, before we kind of get into that, what do you think about those theories just kind of on paper? Do you think they're sound? Do you think it's something that can be applied, or am I talking crazy here?
No, I think you're right. When I first started playing CFF, because the team profiles predate any of my playing CFF, even knowing that CFF was a thing, quite honestly. My co-host of the CFP Winning Edge podcast, Scott Bogman, got me into CFF, I believe, in 2019. So the team profiles were, in their second year. And so when I came in, I had kind of a different mindset than I would have eventually, my mindset evolved a little bit more over the last few years into more of a CFF focused, like thinking like a fantasy player. It's interesting because this year I definitely have not done that. I'm kind of going back to my old ways a little bit. But when I first got into CFF, one of the things that to me was pretty important on my list of priorities, like when I was looking through running backs, for example, I paid a lot of attention to the offensive line. And that's not earth-shattering. People have been paying attention to offensive lines for a long time, but it I think was a little higher on my priority list maybe than the average CFF player. And so it was always not the first thing on the list, but it was something that I thought was maybe more important than the average player. And I've tried to carry that over as I've learned more about, you know, CFF and fantasy football as a whole, and thinking more like a fantasy player, because there definitely are some things, you know, that I didn't get right, putting higher emphasis on, before I learned a little bit more about the game. But yeah, offensive line is definitely something that I like to note, and do think that it is, you know, one of the two or three most important things behind, you know, just whether or not the player is good, and then, you know, are they in a good situation to get a heavy workload? And then I think offensive line, the situation that they're, you know, dealing with as far as experience and talent in that unit up front, is, you know, maybe third on the list to me.
What about on the defensive side of things? Like, again, I kind of mentioned the fact that like a weaker defense probably forces you to have 2 to 3 more scoring opportunities you would each game. The other side of it, I think, is also, again, you have a weaker defense, your game script probably changes a little bit. Again, I'll fully admit I don't have data to back this up. It's just something, some anecdotal evidence I've seen with different teams and everything is like, when you have a defense that, you know, is a sieve and constantly keeps scoring, you're going to have to pass more in order to kind of keep up with the game, the pace of the game for the most part. Versus, again, maybe you can try to run the ball to kind of slow down the game a little bit. Again, but if your defense is going to give up a score every time your guys have the ball, like, you're going to get tired after a while. So you're going to want to go with passing plays to kind of keep up with that pace. Again, do you, anecdotally, Nick, do you kind of agree with that assessment, or how do you feel about it?
I understand where you're coming from. It's something that I've never fully come around to putting a lot of energy into. I think that, you know, and again, I haven't, like you said, I don't have a ton of data to back this up. But for me, that's a little too, I don't know. There's a few too many assumptions, I think, that are being made. Like, yeah, there are definitely bad defenses, and that will impact, you know, more scoring opportunities and things like that.
Think Colorado, USC last couple of years.
And you know, I think there's definitely something to it. But when I think defense, I think a little bit more along the lines of, you know, we've got a lot of stuff for strength of schedule, and we're actually able to break out, you know, what is, you know, who plays, whose schedule has the weakest defenses on it on average. You know, we do like average defensive roster strength, average defensive team performance, of the schedule, things like that. So I'm more interested in that sort of thing than I am, you know, how good my quarterback's own defense is. But if you are, I mean, that's the beauty of this. You know, the information is there. So what I think doesn't matter. And I say that a lot when it comes to, you know, using our team profiles for, you know, projected point spreads or power rankings, things like that. My opinion is not a factor one bit in any of this. I just put the information together, put it out there, and you can use it for whatever you want. So maybe, you know, you've unlocked something that just never really quite clicked for me. So it doesn't matter whether or not I, you know, act on it or understand it. If you do, and the information is available to you in the team profiles, and you're able to use it and you know, turn that into something that's going to help you win your league, then hey, that's great. My opinion doesn't matter.
For sure. All righty. Again, we'll get into some of these actual specific teams here in a second. Quick announcement, real quick. One, obviously, we've been talking about the team profiles. Go check it out, campusagain.com. It's part of the C2C Winning Edge package. It is a monthly subscription we have over there. If you can't tell already, like, I am over the moon excited about being able to dive into this stuff. Lots of unique ways that you can use that information. So go check that out. Also, of course, as always, gotta pump the Defending the Natty podcast we have here on the feed, our CFF Dynasty podcast. Again, check out the latest episode with myself and Nate Marquise, where we discussed freshmen, instant impact, stashes, and fades. Next month, and by the time you're listening to this, it'll be Monday. So be on the lookout Wednesday for episode 5, where we're going to discuss some of those supplemental players. We'll be talking about some high-end guys, some instant starters, some good depth pieces, and also some potential sashes that you can get out of those guys as well. So be on the lookout for that. That's enough of my spiel. Let's go ahead and actually start talking about some of these teams, Nick. So we'll start with offensive lines. And we're going to start with some teams that, according to your numbers, Nick, are going to see some regression of play along the offensive line. So here we have North Carolina. North Carolina will be the first team we talk about here today. Their O-line position strength was 85.39 last year. Now it is 79.50. That is a drop in 5.89. If I remember correctly, North Carolina is the fourth biggest drop among teams off the top of my head, Nick. So that kind of gives you the basic raw numbers, Nick. But what do these numbers mean? How do you come up with this offensive position strength or offensive line position strength number? And then also, like, how big is a drop of 5.89 relative to, again, a lot of teams? I just mentioned they're number four in the year, but, like, compared to previous years, like, is that a big drop? Is that kind of normal for a team? What do you think? Or I guess not, what do you think? Tell me about these numbers.
great question. I should have touched on this first, probably. So the numbers that you're referencing are come from our individual player ratings, which are built on raw recruiting data coming out of high school and then adjusted for experience and career production. They're also known as video game ratings. So think of, you know, college football, EA Sports College Football 25 coming out soon, right? Same idea. These team profiles were built after the video game went away, but that was something I grew up playing a ton, you know, Madden, FIFA. You can think of these numbers very, very similarly. And what that O-line position strength number indicates is the average video game rating of those five projected starters on the offensive line. And then that is a weighted average with the, you know, second team, the second five, and then the rest of the roster. So you think of, okay, the, you know, very in its most simple terms, North Carolina's offensive line at the end of last year had about an average rating of 85.5, right? So that's, you know, decent. It's better than FBS average, but not elite by any stretch. This year, they've lost almost 6 full points from that point last season. And how do we get to that point? Well, 4 full-time starters are gone. They have not added a ton of experience. They're expected to likely start 3 incoming first year transfers, but none of those players are, you know, super experienced, didn't play, you know, more than 10% of their team snaps last year, for example. One full-time starter is back. That's Willie Lampkin. He was a transfer who started his career at Coastal Carolina. So he didn't come in with a super high, recruiting rating coming out of high school. So it's just not a very talented unit on paper, and we haven't been able to see yet, because it's an inexperienced unit, whether or not they actually play very well. So we can't necessarily make the assumption that they will play well until we see it. And we, you know, our offensive line performance ratings, which is another thing that we have, you just can't really assume, especially when there are 4 new starters and 3 incoming transfers who are likely to start, that it's going to be a very good unit. So on paper, it looks like, based on that lack of talent, or at least a downgrade in raw talent numbers, downgrade in experience, also because there's no experience or very little, those players haven't been able to accumulate production, which on the offensive line, we look at things like PFF grades and how they perform in other stats like sack percentages and line yards and things like that for the running game. So very complicated answer, but think of it as just like, all right, how do these, if this were a video game, how do these players rate on average, with the starters carrying more weight than everybody else? And North Carolina has just taken a big step back from last year. And you said you had it right. This was the fourth biggest drop off of any offensive line unit in the country. And you know, it's in sort of a danger zone. Any year you're in the bottom 10% in any of these kind of year over year changes, it's likely to be a major impact, where it could very well be an issue.
So what you're telling me is that the people, including myself, who have been drafting Amarian Hampton in the first round, going RB3 in drafts, kind of typically around the seventh, eighth pick, even a little bit higher in some drafts, this should be concerning to us. Is that what you're telling me?
It's one piece of information. Compare Amarian Hampton to Ollie Gordon, right? Ollie Gordon has all five of his offensive line starters coming back. So that is an experienced unit, even though it, you know, doesn't grade out super well as far as talent goes. There's a lot of continuity there. There's experience, there's production that that unit's been able to gain working together. So they're actually moving in a positive direction. So, you know, that kind of indicates where two players pretty close in ADP, they're just dealing with different situations. Now, North Carolina could be, even though we can't account for, you know, we can't expect this unit to be as good as it was last year when they ranked 35th in our offensive line performance rating. We also can't guarantee that they will be terrible. So I, you know, I've seen some folks who follow North Carolina very closely, who, you know, based on what they saw this spring, based on, you know, research that they've done on some of these incoming transfers and things like that, think that this unit has a chance to still be pretty good. Just again, looking at it on paper, on how these players stack up based on what's still there from last year, what, you know, players have moved on due to graduation, things like that. What transfers are coming in and what experience they have coming in. It's one, you know, piece of information that doesn't look particularly good. So I'm, you know, still thinking that Amarian Hampton's gonna be in a good position, right? He's gonna get a very heavy workload, especially
For
with
sure.
Drake May moving on, especially with those wide receivers who are just decimated by injury this spring. They're probably gonna lean on Hampton, you know, pretty well. And maybe this offensive line, because of that, you know, gels pretty quickly and becomes a pretty good run blocking unit that they'll continue to lean on throughout the course of the season. So that is definitely a possibility. But also we do have to, you know, if we're looking across the country, this is an outlier as far as the amount of just overall experience and production that, you know, an offensive line unit's going to have to replace.
One more general question I have for you, Nick, regarding your team profiles and how people can use the information about O-lines found within it. Say, like, I see this big drop right here at North Carolina, but I'm kind of curious on, all right, is this going to affect the pass protection or the run game more? Like, depending on like their lack of experience and everything, right? Like, is there a way I can use your team profiles to kind of find out that information?
That's a really good question, and that's something we haven't taken that next step to break out, you know, pass blocking offensive line compared to a run blocking offensive line. I'd love to do that someday if we can, but right now
Okay.
those O-line performance numbers incorporate both run blocking and pass blocking, so it's all kind of thrown in together.
Okay.
That is a great question. That is something that, you know, maybe someday we'll be able to add into the mix.
Yeah, because I was wondering here, like, not that anybody's out here drafting like Max Johnson in CFF leagues or anything like that, but or actually might be better suited for our next team we'll talk about here, Kansas State. They also saw a pretty big drop here, again going from 82.63 down to 77.58, a drop of 5.05 on their offensive line position strength rating here. This is one of those questions, right, where you're like, okay, is this going to impact DJ Giddens more, or is it going to impact Avery Johnson? Both of those guys getting drafted pretty highly in drafts. Obviously, if this downgrade in offensive line showed like, okay, their pass blocking is very inexperienced at this point. Meanwhile, they might, like, say they brought in some transfers from, like, a good running game system where they had a lot of run blocking snaps. Maybe it's a good thing still for DJ Giddens. But like you said, you haven't broken that out. Totally fine. I think that would be a very fun project for the future. So, speaking of Kansas State, can you tell me about what's going on here? Again, obviously dropping a whole 5 points. We just talked about with UNC, not a good thing whatsoever. But what has Kansas State done to try to replace that? And how do you anticipate this group going into the season? And who do you think it affects more?
So on you know, who's coming back, who's not. K-State is another team that is got a good bit of turnover. There's one full-time starter from last year's unit returning. K-State last year graded out in the same ballpark as North Carolina. North Carolina was 35th in O-line performance. K-State was 44th last season. So better than FBS average, but not in the elite category. Obviously, you know, did some good work for DJ Giddens, and then Avery Johnson, as you mentioned, somebody who's got a really exciting future. But K-State is a team that doesn't recruit at a particularly high level as far as, you know, your traditional recruiting metrics. So, you know, that average, that O-line position strength rating, even last year, was right around or below FBS average. That just the way we calculate things in offensive line is difficult. Like I think we do a pretty good job of capturing some of these things, but even the work we put into it, you know, as you mentioned with the not having a pass block versus a run blocking, the ability to differentiate between the two, there are definitely some things that we just haven't been able to do just yet. So offensive line's hard. It's hard for talent evaluators. And at a place like Kansas State, which traditionally outperforms its talent profile, I mean, you know, there have been for decades, right? K-State guys who came in as walk-ons or junior college players that, you know, had no offers coming out of high school who end up becoming NFL draft picks. So, you know, maybe we're underrating K-State. Maybe some of these guys that they've got coming up are being developed into really, really good players. But on paper, there's one full-time starter returning. That's Hadley Panzer starting right guard. There's a part-time starter at right tackle, Carver Willis. And then they added a starter through the transfer portal who had 35 career starts at the FCS level. That's Easton Kilty. So there's just, you know, similar amount of turnover. One player was, you know, an all-the-time starter on last year's unit, very similar to North Carolina. And they're just pulling from, you know, replacements that are on paper considered to be not as talented. So the numbers are just, you know, there's a little bit of a downtick because there's less experience for this unit. A lot of guys to replace, one in particular, highly drafted player from last year's team. And they are not filling those holes with guys who've played a lot of football at the FBS level. There is, you know, one very, very experienced Division I left tackle, but, you know, somebody who hasn't played in a power conference, hasn't played at the FBS level. So it's just difficult to expect, again, on paper, for this unit to perform at the same level based on the amount of snaps that they've got to replace, the amount of talent that you know, some of those guys ended up being, even if they weren't, you know, four-star recruits coming out of high school.
So it's kind of similar question to Amari and Hampton, right? Obviously, Amari Hampton going a little bit higher than DJ Giddens, but DJ Giddens, according to my most recent ADP, sneaking up into the first round now, an ADP at 11.9 here. Nick, if you're in a CFF draft right now, knowing the turnover here at offensive line, would you be comfortable taking DJ Giddens in the first round?
I think that seems a little high to me. Because, you know, Avery Johnson can take off and run, scramble. It's going to, you know, score some. I think that hurts Giddens a little bit. You know, a month ago, Giddens was in a situation where there was very little depth behind him. Now, you know, not that Dylan Edwards is going to be a superstar, going to come in and take in a significant amount of snaps away, but he did he's a talented guy, came in, added some depth to that running back room, fits kind of a similar profile. I'm not saying he's Deuce Vaughn, but on the smaller side, speedier side, can catch the ball out of the backfield. So I feel like he's going to have a role. So I think it's the offensive line is a piece of it, and I don't love the that big negative red number that you've got on the screen scares me just a little bit. But I think beyond that, it's the quarterback is going to be a productive runner. There's a little more depth at the running back position behind Giddens than there were, so they won't have to ride him. They probably don't want, for him to be on the field for 64% of snaps like he was last year. They probably want to give him a little bit more of a breather. So I think the combination of those factors and the offensive line being one of those would make me, kind of think that through and see if there might be somebody that has some things pointing a little more in a positive direction than the negative direction like that number on the screen there.
For sure. All right. One more team we'll talk about here that is getting hit with a weaker offensive line this year. And Nick, you specifically requested to talk about this team, and that is UTEP, a team we don't typically talk about here. And so again, this is a perfect opportunity to talk about them because, good Lord, they're going from an offensive line position strength in 2023 of 74.49, an already pretty low number, to 69.68 this year in 2024, a drop of 7.03. Nick, besides the fact that those numbers are what you're going to read as a scary bedtime story to your children in the future, what all is going on here with UTEP, and how does this impact really anything to do with CFF or the CFF potential of anybody on this roster?
Well, so thinking long term, I'm kind of excited about UTEP. I don't know, how many folks out there know much about Scotty Walden, the new
That
head
is
coach there.
the most Nicholas Ian Allen sentence I've ever heard in my life. I am excited about UTEP this year.
I am. I think Scotty Walden is. I mean, who are the most positive, energetic head coaches you can think of? I mean, Kenny Dillingham comes to mind maybe a little bit. Scotty Walden's kind of like at a different level. So I think that he is going to, assuming they come in, they can win a little bit, and he stays for a little while, I think UTEP's going to be fun. I mean, he's coming from Austin Peay, brought a bunch of players with him from Austin Peay, that could pay off. We've seen some programs that kind of imported a lot of their FCS roster. It happened last year at Texas State, happened a few years ago at Western Kentucky. Will it pay off at UTEP? Not sure, but it is such an unknown that, I mean, yeah, the numbers look pretty scary on paper. Once we fully incorporate all the FCS players coming in, maybe that number will improve a little bit. That is a little bit of a benefit of the way we do things team profile wise. I mean, you can think of it as like your Phil Steele magazine, if Phil Steele was able to update it every day and when new information came, and sometimes things get a little better, things get a little worse. So UTEP maybe won't be the worst, biggest drop off once they're ready to kick off the season. But as it stands right now, I mean, there are just so many holes to fill on that offense as a whole. And I was getting a little excited, like I said, about UTEP and maybe Javon Jackson. I mean, he was a 1,300 yard rusher at Austin Peay last year, right? Almost had 9 touchdowns on the ground. There's some receivers that put up some good numbers, but this offensive line is just a complete rebuild. There are only 2 players who have starting experience at the FBS level. Only 4 guys who played any snaps at all at the FBS level last season. Don't have to spend a ton of time on it, but it was notable to me for that, but also because UTEP actually graded out as one of our very best units in the country in O-line performance last year. So, they were up towards the very, very top in those stats, like, line yards and some pass blocking stats, run blocking stats. The combination of those, if you end up, finishing as one of the best in the country, you're probably pretty good at both. And for them to go from that to a just complete rebuild of that unit, struck me as interesting.
Yeah, it definitely puts a little bit of a hamper on anybody who might have saw a potential CFF. Like, there's still some potential sleepers here. Like Scotty Waldman had a pretty decent offense last year. You already mentioned Javon Jackson. I've definitely taken my fair shares of him late in drafts at the running back position when I feel like there's not much else going on at it past the 25th round of a draft. But it definitely puts a little bit of hamper on the excitement of like, oh, maybe they get it going in year one, CUSA and everything like that. But no, this offensive line is even bad, at least, or again, I can't say bad. You're right, Nick. I can't assume, but the numbers are bad compared to even other CUSA teams, right? And so
One way I think of it is yeah, we can't assume they're going to be bad, but based on we also can't assume they're going to be any good. So they're more negative factors. There's more reason to expect that it's going to be a worse unit than there is evidence to suggest they're going to be as good or better. Just seems like a probability problem to me.
no, for sure. All right, let's get positive, Nick. We've been negative on plenty of these teams here, and we'll talk about a team that I'll admit I have been very harsh on their O-line. I continuously bring up the fact that South Carolina had one of the worst offensive line performances in the country, let alone just the SEC or the Power Five. No, I'm talking about all of FBS. They had one of the worst performing O-lines last year, especially in sacks given up, just absolutely atrocious. But according to you, Nick, and your numbers, they should see some improvement this year. They're going from a offensive line position strength rating of 78.28 last year, which is just abysmal for SEC, to 82.53. So that's an increase of 4.25 on their offensive line position strength rating there. Nick, what did South Carolina do to improve their rating here? And do you think it'll be enough to impact guys like Lenore Sellers? Do you think they can actually get a running game going this year, potentially? How do you think this impacts the Gamecocks moving forward?
Well, it's the inverse of what we were talking about before. It's not a guarantee that they will be better. The SEC, the strength of schedules have just gotten more and more ridiculous with the addition of Texas and Oklahoma. South Carolina is in a pretty tough spot anyway, but it's an experienced group. There are four players who started eight games or more last season who return. There are two other players with starting experience on last year's team who return. They added experienced starter in Kamar Bell, who had has 29 career starts under his belt. There's an incoming center. North Carolina, or excuse me, South Carolina gets pretty creative at times in the transfer portal, goes down to lower levels, FCS, and sometimes even lower. They've had some success at the Division II level in the past at the running back position, Mario Anderson. But there's a center coming in, Terselli Simpkins III, who was a 35-game starter at North Carolina Central at the FCS level. So they're bringing back four guys who are quote unquote starters, get their name in bold in our team profiles from last year's team. And then they add other experienced players on top of that. So they've got, at least again on paper, a wealth of experience, one of the higher numbers of just raw stats, or excuse me, starts and snaps returning from last year's season. Plus, they add to that with guys who, got a lot of experience at other places. So it's no guarantee they're going to improve. You mentioned poor performance last year. They were 97th in our O-line performance ratings last season. Some of that was injury. They definitely did have some of their best players lose time due to injury. And that's going to be something to watch, because I know there was an injury prior to the spring game of a player who looked like he might be competing for some contributing snaps, if not a full-time starter. But on paper, looks pretty good. They've got a lot coming back, and my other co-host of the CFP Winning Edge podcast, Xavier Trish, has a saying that I think is his. Maybe he heard it somewhere else. I've only ever heard him say it, but he says, when we talk returning production and things like that, and oh yeah, all these numbers of starters are coming back. And he says, I don't care about that because old garbage just stinks more. So I do try to keep that in mind. Just because a unit is experienced doesn't mean it's going to get any better. But it's one of those positive signs where, you hope over the course of a full year together, these full-time starters, and then you add other players who are experienced, that is going to have a positive effect. There's at least more evidence to me to expect movement in a positive direction than a negative direction. So will this be one of the very best offensive lines in the SEC? Probably not. But if you're thinking about can somebody like Rocket Sanders bounce back, maybe. I mean, he's stepping into a decent situation, at least as far as having an experienced group up there in front of him. If you're thinking about Lenora Sellers, stepping in as a first-time starter in the SEC, well, at least he's got guys up front who've been there before, who've got some experience under their belt. Might not have been the best unit in the country last season, but hopefully, that continuity, that experience is going to be a positive thing, and that group will play a little bit better, for those guys in 2024.
Yeah, totally understandable. I don't really have much else to add. You did a good job breaking it down, so I guess we'll just go ahead and move on to some of the other teams here that have improved their offensive line ratings. Another team we don't really get to talk about enough, in my opinion, is Cincinnati. Again, obviously, I was pretty high on Emory Jones last year. It was a great week one when he ripped off like 50 points against some poor FCS school. Then just completely fell apart the rest of the season. But, year two, Scott Satterfield, Brennan Soresby there as a quarterback. You got Corey Kiner coming back, Xavier Henderson back as their lead receiver. I think there's a lot to be excited about for Cincinnati this year. And Nick, you're just adding fuel to the fire here in terms of your numbers here because their offensive line, similar to South Carolina, improving. 76.62 was their offensive line position strength rating last year. Now you have it added as an 81.55. That's an increase of 4.93. Again, just I imagine it's very similar to South Carolina what they've done, but what did Cincinnati do here to kind of improve their offensive line rating? And again, same question. Is it going to help out these guys like Soresby, Kiner, and the rest?
I think so. I mean, it's like everything we said about South Carolina, except it's even more simple. Everybody's back. The front five, everybody who started 11 or more games last season is back. They only lose one start from last year's group. So Cincinnati ranks among the highest in the country. If you're just looking at percentage of overall offensive line snaps or starts returning from last season, they got 96.7% of their snaps from last year, 98.3% of their starts. So that's a good starting point. Their performance rating, pretty similar to South Carolina last year. They were 85th in O-line performance. But again, not only is it an experienced group, but that entire unit was together last season. Guys were, playing every game, every snap, and in their same positions, which I think is important. I mean, you look across the offensive line, everybody who's expected to start at each position played at least 722 snaps at that position last year, and four out of the five were over 800. So continuity, it's not everything, but to me, it's a positive data point. And so Cincinnati coming back, have a year to get acclimated to their new environment in the Big 12. Corey Kiner back, and being able to insert him in, and Evan Pryor at running back, some other guys that they brought in to add depth there. Seems like it's a step in a positive direction for that group, rushing offense specifically, which was a relative strength for Cincinnati last season. They were top 40 in our offensive team performance numbers as far as rushing offense goes. And then, you mentioned Scott Satterfield. He had a pretty good track record at Louisiana or Louisville,
Louisville.
excuse me, and App State prior to that. So, I'm thinking that this year we're going to see something, maybe closer to those units where they were really among quite efficient rushing offenses. That maybe there's a recipe for Cincinnati to take even another step in that direction with so much experience coming back on the offensive line.
So, Nick, how much, so like, say all five starters return on a team. Just from experience alone, how many points do you think that adds to an offensive line's positional strength rating? Because like here, obviously Cincinnati jumps up 4.93 points. Like, how many points out of the 4.93 there would you say is just due to that increased experience?
I could give you an exact number actually if I
Oh,
went back
really?
and reran it. Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, but
Ah.
I can tell you. So this is getting really in the weeds. You know I like to ramble on,
Let's
so
do this.
cut me off. But so when I say recruiting adjusted for experience and then production, when a guy is a junior, their recruiting rating gets 91% of their, full recruiting rating, and that's what their just sort of raw video game rating is. At the offensive line, there's not a ton of ways that you can add production other than, like I said, some of those stats and PFF scores and things like that. So if a guy goes from a junior to a senior, their experience gets bumped up from 91% to 93%. So that usually adds a point or two. But then also, if I go and look at things like PFF grades, where somebody like Luke Kandre, right guard, performed pretty well, they get other additional points added, based on those PFF grades. So Kandre specifically added 6 production points to his rating from 2023, what was in the 2023 team profiles. In addition to, I give a point of production for every 5 career starts on the offensive line. Offensive line is the only position that gets any sort of production points for
Simply
starts.
starting
But
a game.
right, so he had double digit starts, so he added 2 production points for that. He gets a little bit of a bump for experience, and then had some pretty good PFF grade, so he's actually able to end up adding 6 total points. So last year he was like a high 70 in his video game rating. This year he's mid 80s. So
Very nice.
it adds. It could be 2, could be 3, could be 6, could be more if somebody really, really grades out well. But there's it's not huge gains usually, but Cincinnati did have a couple of guys. Their center, Gavin Gerhardt, graded out pretty well, so he got some additional points. Their left guard, Dontarian Tinsley, graded out well, so he got a little bit of extra. So that interior of the offensive line, not only is it experienced, but they've actually proven that they play pretty well too, at least as
Yeah.
far as folks like PFF and some other things that we look at take into account. So yeah, vague rambling, but we do try to account and actually put a number on there where we can.
Nick, you are not rambling whatsoever, man. I'm just a student here. I'm learning. I find what you do fascinating with this. So like, I'm just sitting back soaking it in. I'm only hoping that everybody out there listening is doing the same here. One more team we'll discuss that is improving their offensive line here, and that is Wake Forest. Definitely one of the more disappointing teams last year. Obviously, we've loved what Dave Clawson's been able to do with some of his teams in the past. Think Jamie Newman, think Sam Hartman, of course, think guys like Sage Sherrod, think guys like, oh my goodness, why are some of the other Ojaquari Roberson have been big time CFF producers. Then last year things just kind of fell apart. And I think part of what you can point to is the 77.5 offensive line position strength rating that they had last year. Obviously there was some quarterback play issues with Mitch Griffiths as well, but they're now improving again. They're back up to 79.94, an increase of 2.44. So, Nick, kind of same question as the last two teams. What did they do to improve things here? And is it enough to kind of get Wake Forest back on track to being a CFF relevant team here, at least a step in the right direction for them?
So Wake Forest is kind of similar to Kansas State, where they don't bring in a lot of four-star guys. They're relying on developmental players. The offensive line is a very developmental position. So sometimes you get guys who are tight ends in high school or defensive linemen in high school, and you bring in, give them a scholarship and say you're going to play offensive line, and we have to teach them how to get in a stance before you even do anything else. So it's tough. So on paper, Wake Forest is a team that, doesn't look super, super talented, but they do have a pretty decent track record of finding players like that at a variety of positions, not just offensive line. But they've got some experience coming back, three full-time starters, including Devontae Gordon, their left tackle, who has 39 career starts under his belt. They also added a 20-plus game starter from the FCS level at Keegan Trost. And so it's an experience unit that has Gordon specifically, graded out pretty well. So he was able to add some more production points to his tally. He's up at a 90-plus player rating now. So, really kind of an all-ACC caliber tackle. So when you get, one really, really good player who's proven it, to the point where he's a, 3, 4 year type starter playing at an all conference level, then it's something to build around. You add a couple of other full-time starters, bring up somebody from, an FCS level as a transfer, offensive line, those guys are very, very hot commodities in the transfer portal if they've been a starter at the FCS level or things like that. Those guys are getting, dozens of offers. So when you're able to add one to the mix, it helps. So getting Trost in, throw him in the mix with three full-time starters. And then they've got a couple of other guys who even, they weren't full-time starters, but got experience, got, 29 or 30 or 35% of last year's snaps as well. So those guys, getting acclimated, getting some playing time, even if they, aren't the quote unquote returning starters, still have some experience and should help that unit gel a little bit. But yeah, Wake Forest jumped out to me because I mean, I know on this show you guys have talked about Devon Claiborne a bit, right? I know Nate's been high on him for a long time. And looking at the offensive line, at least on paper, based on what's coming back, there's maybe a chance that's going to be a little bit better this season. It was an average, FBS average unit last season, 77th in our O-line performance. So maybe there's a chance, especially if you're getting some transition at quarterback, wide receiver. You lose Jamal Banks transferring out to Wake Forest. Not sure if Donovan Green's back fully 100% yet. So maybe they lean on Claiborne as they're trying to figure out, is Hank Bachmeier our guy? Is the true freshman Jeremy Heklinski? Are we going to transition to him? And if you throw a true freshman into the mix, you're probably going to want to lean on that running game a bit. So that to me, looking at that unit, how it graded out last year, at least some of the best players who are returning, gives me some hope that maybe Claiborne's in a pretty good position to pay off on some of that potential that he's shown in the past.
Yeah, Claiborne's definitely a very interesting guy. I know, like you mentioned, Nate Marquise has been high on him for a while. He wants Claiborne out of Wake Forest. He's just like he doesn't trust Dave Clawson with running backs whatsoever, and I don't blame him because Claiborne's had himself some huge games, and Dave Clawson just for some reason refuses to give him a rock. RB 104. If this is the year, you could get him at a pretty decent price right now. Again, he's going. This is a guy you're talking about, like ADP 323. Again, doing the math off the top of my head, you're talking about at least past the 25th round right there. If he's getting drafted at all in your leagues, somebody to keep in mind. And like you said, Nick could very well benefit from an improved O line here. Enough offensive line discussion, Nick. Let's go over to defenses and talk about some of these teams that are seeing a slight uptick or decrease in their defensive ratings from last year. And of course, the first team we're going to talk about here is a team that doesn't actually see that much change in its defensive roster strength rating. So this kind of feels a little counterintuitive, but it is something I wanted to bring up because when people think of LSU's defense last year, right, they think it was atrocious. And it was. It was absolutely horrendous, and it was great for college fantasy, right? That was part of the reason why Jaden Daniels was so incredible last year, because LSU had to score 40 points every single game, and it forced the starters to stay out there in order to score those points. Their defensive roster strength rating here goes from 93.92 to 94.08, only increase of 0.16. But if you notice the raw numbers I mentioned there, 93 and 94, that you would not think that a team with as bad of a defense as we had last year would be anywhere in the 90s when it comes to this defensive roster strength rating. So, Nick, I guess this is a good time to potentially talk about the difference between the roster strength ratings versus the performance ratings, and how potentially, like, if LSU made the right hire at defensive coordinator here, right, how quickly this defense could turn around just based on the talent that's there. And if you're going into the season drafting Garrett Nussmeier being like, oh, that defense is going to be bad again this year, he's going to have to score 40 points a game, maybe not the best assumption to make here, in my opinion. So, Nick, how do you kind of feel about that?
Yeah, so hopefully I'll be able to hit all my points and not forget anything. First, on the, you know, the change in defensive roster strength, you mentioned it's roughly the same as it was last year, and that doesn't, you know, sound like a major improvement. But the way that we compare these are the preseason numbers this year compared to the very end of the season last year. So even though LSU was really poor defensively last season, I mean, they were triple digits in our national rankings in defensive team performance overall, passing and rushing. They were 109, 113, and 122 respectively. So one of the worst defenses in the country. But even with that being the case, some of the players who were on that unit were talented players rated pretty high. You know, that 93.9, as you mentioned, think of that as an average. I mean, it's very similar, right? It's the average individual player rating weighted for starters carrying the most of that entire defense. So you're thinking guys who are former five and four star players. And there were multiple NFL draft picks on the defensive line, Mason Smith and McKee Wingo. Yep. There were other guys who were, experienced, highly rated players like Andre Sam and Omar Spates, who were, playing quite a bit, racked up a lot of tackles last season, accounted for other things that are going to add to their level of production and those player ratings with, tackles for loss and sacks and pressures that we track all of that. And that goes into those individual player ratings as well. So when players like that leave and roughly sort of the average amount of turnover from one year to the next for every team has been, one third. There's going to be a little bit of a drop off. So even though they're only, roughly the same roster strength, they're still ranking the top 25 nationally as far as, moving in the right direction. They haven't lost much ground. A lot of other defenses are losing players to the NFL, losing players to graduation, or losing outgoing transfers, and have to replace those players somehow. And usually roster strength numbers go down from the end of one year to the next. So that's one piece of it. Two, again, getting back to those, raw numbers, this LSU defense is very, very talented. They rank fifth nationally in defensive roster strength. So that 94.08, only four teams in the country rank higher on the defensive side of the ball. So as bad as they were last year, they look way, 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 way better on paper. There has been a change at defensive coordinator. So, will you be able to fix everything and turn that into a top five defense, play up to the level of their talent? That's maybe not the most reasonable expectation, but you only have to look to last year and what a team like UCLA did, where they made the right hire at defensive coordinator, got it, D'Anton Lynn, brought him in, took a unit that he inherited that ranked 111th in defensive team performance overall and turned it into a top three team in defensive team performance, and didn't have nearly as much talent on hand as LSU. So if LSU made the right hire, bringing in defensive coordinator from Missouri, you can have a huge, huge one-year turnaround. But also, all that being said, and going back to your original point where, Jaden Daniels was really able to capitalize because this LSU defense was so bad. Was that it? Or is the LSU defense gas because Jaden Daniels and Malik Nabers and whoever else were just, boom, touchdown, quick drive, big score. Maybe it was Jaden Daniels' fault that the LSU defense was so bad, or at least that's a little bit of a factor. So maybe the fact that, Jaden Daniels and that receiving core and all that, there's so much turnover there. Maybe LSU, the defense might have just a little bit more of an opportunity to catch its breath a little bit, and that could pay off. Maybe not in a huge way, turn it into one of the best defenses in the country, but if this LSU defense could, get back to FBS average instead of being one of the, bottom 10% defenses in the country, that from a team perspective, I think that's gonna really pay off. So, fantasy impact, again, there's so many factors for me. I just haven't been able to fully wrap my head around it. But yeah, I think there's reason to expect this LSU defense is going to be better because it's hard to get much worse. But on paper, they should get much better or have the potential to get much better.
No, for sure. And I think part of it is the answer, of course, as with most things, the answer is probably somewhere in the middle, right? Between the LSU offense just being that good, that explosive. You're probably right, it does gas out the LSU defense. But also at the same time, right? Like, I think you can answer that a little bit. Again, I can't recall off the top of my head, but if it was the LSU defense getting gassed by the offense of Jaden Daniels, Brian Thomas, and Malik Nabers and all of that, like, you would see that in the box scores in terms of like quarter by quarter, right? Does LSU get out to big leads and then give them up late in the game? That kind of goes to your point, right? That they're scoring too fast, the defense gets gassed. Or is if LSU is like constantly neck and neck with these teams throughout all four quarters, or they're falling behind and then have to catch up, then it's probably a bit more along the lines of just the defense was performing poorly overall. But obviously, I don't have those numbers in front of me, so I can't make any
Well,
kind
and there
of,
were injuries. I mean,
well,
there's
true. Yeah,
so
so
many
many
different
factors,
things that
right?
go
Yeah.
into it.
So.
But it is just something to keep in mind. Sometimes the defense gets a stop on third down. They give the ball to the offense. Offense scores on the first play, and the defense goes, "Oh, you got to
Right,
get back out there."
here we go again. No, totally a fair thing to bring up. All right, so moving on from LSU, let's go back to a team that's probably a bit more like traditional in terms of what we were going to talk about, and that is Virginia. Virginia last year, defensive roster strength rating of 83.73. This year, 86.48. Pretty solid. Again, increasing their defensive roster strength rating by 2.75, which, as you mentioned, Nick, you're not going to see nearly as big of swings on the positive side as you are on the negative side, just because naturally teams lose so much at the NFL, especially among experienced guys. So adding 2.75% or 2%, excuse me, just 2.75 points in general is a very impressive feat. So I guess one, how did Virginia do it? And two, again, kind of going back to my theory and everything, does this impact a guy like, obviously Malik Washington's gone, but we're drafting guys like Malachi Fields. Some people are taking shots at Anthony Calandrea at the end of drafts. People taking shots on Chris Tyree. Is it possible that Virginia not needing to score as much probably hinders those guys a bit more this year? Or is it just a fact that, again, Malik Washington just got an absurd number of targets last year, and we probably are reading into this too much into this offense regardless? So how do you see Virginia and the impact this defense could have?
Well, I think, first of all, Virginia was a real pleasant surprise offensively last year. Washington was definitely a big part of that. When we saw Calandria, he was like this chaotic good. Like, was he actually good? I don't know, but he made things happen, and some of those
A
things were
great
big plays.
example of eff it ball.
Yeah. So that's a real step in the right direction, to your point, to your observation, was that offense in some ways a benefit of the defense being pretty bad? They were 113th in our defensive team performance numbers last year. So there's a lot of room for improvement. Some of that improvement we expect is going to come with experience in the front seven. They bring back a lot of that, full defensive line and linebacker group almost in full. And then, though there is a lot of turnover in the secondary, Virginia really hit the transfer portal hard with guys who were experienced at lower levels. Brought in guys who played a lot at places like Robert Morris, Penn, not Penn State, but the University of Pennsylvania, Ivy League, Akron, Eastern Michigan. So brought in starters, guys who played a lot of snaps other places, haven't, stepped up and played FBS football in a power conference quite yet. But add some depth and then throw in a guy like Antonio Clary, who missed all of last season due to injury, somebody who was a starter in the past. So again, on paper, it's kind of like those offensive lines where they're in some instances the unit comes back with a lot of experience, and then where there are some potential holes, Virginia did a pretty good job of addressing those holes with players who have played a lot of football, regardless of whether they are, super talented, maybe not. Most of those defensive back transfers coming in are going to be roughly FBS average, guys in the mid-80s. One, Kendron Smith, the UPenn longtime starter, he's the only one who cracked 90, and then a couple of the other, like the Robert Morris guy, he's in the high 70s. So are they going to be major impact players, who are going to end up stepping up to be all conference players? Probably not, but they at least helped a unit that looked like it could have been maybe one of the worst of any P5 school. They raised the floor a little bit so that hopefully, Virginia is gonna play a little bit better defensively next season. Again, a lot of teams that are in the triple digits in our rankings, our team performance rankings, my hope for them when I'm, trying to project some optimism is just, hey, just play FBS average defense and your team is going to get a lot better, going to win more. Virginia, if that defense can be a top 75 unit, then Virginia probably has a pretty good shot to make it to a bowl game next year.
And I'm sure Virginia fans will love it, but will it impact our love of, or our temporary love of Tony Elliott and the fact that they were feeding their top receivers a ton? Malachi Fields currently going as wide receiver 27, seventh round in best ball drafts right now. Nick, do you feel comfortable with that, knowing the changes that Virginia's made on the defensive side of the ball, or just in general with Virginia?
So I think there's reason to be optimistic about Fields. I mean, he was targeted 100 times last year. He's 6'4". So even though some of what I read early in spring camp was that Tyree might be the guy who kind of slots into that role that Washington played specifically last year, I still think that Fields is in line to get the most targets of anybody else and might get a huge, huge number. Last year he and Washington were both, there were combined targets of 238, right? The next closest player was 24 targets. That was Kobe Pace, the running back. So
It was just
it
insane
makes
how
me
much they targeted those two.
sure. So this year it's a little bit different because they added Tyree, they added Andre Green Jr., former really highly rated recruit who signed with North Carolina. They added Trell Harris, who got quite a bit of action in the MAC the last couple of years. So again, on paper, it looks like a deeper wide receiver group to where maybe instead of just two good players getting all the targets, you have one really good player getting hopefully still the same amount of targets in Fields, but a deeper group where hopefully you can spread it out a little bit. What does it mean for CFF? I'm not sure. I think that Fields, based on what we saw last year, is in a good position to get a lot of targets again. But is he going to get 140 targets like Malik Washington did? Maybe not, because I think they actually did add some depth to that unit.
Nope, totally fair. All right, let's move on to some defenses that have seen quite a big drop. And the biggest name, really, on the list that we saw here was the Alabama Crimson Tide. Now, I think part of this is obviously there is some drop off here because they had a ton of guys go off to the NFL draft. But also, like, as you look at this raw rating that they had last year for the defensive roster strength, this is just insane. Nick, I didn't know you could go above 100 with your defensive roster strength. Last year, 2023, Alabama had a defensive roster strength of 101.38. They are now down to 92.33. That's a whole 9.05 point drop there. Obviously, as we mentioned before, like, with players losing players to the NFL, you're going to see wilder swings on the negative side. But that's still a pretty big drop. But also, does it matter considering how high they already were before? They're still at 92.33. Again, given what you said about LSU being 94, and that's top five in the nation, this probably still puts Alabama in the top 10. If we go off my theory and everything, right, of like, you know, technically Alabama's a worse defense, but how much, but in this case, how much does it really matter when clearly still pretty dang good? What do you think, Nick?
So Alabama does have some areas where they could really improve. The secondary in particular was hardest hit in my opinion. And I think that the numbers would show that as well. So defensive roster strength, they currently rank 12th. So just a little outside of the top 10. So still one of the very, very good defenses, you know, talented across the board. They still rank very high. One of the things that we do offer in our team profiles, you can see position by position, the average recruiting rating coming out of high school for 247, Rivals, and On3. And you look at the Alabama defense, I mean, they are top four at all three levels of the defense, just in that raw recruiting rating. Number one defensive line across the board, number two at linebacker across the board. They're fourth in 247 rating and Rivals in defensive backs, and they're number two in On3 rating in defensive backs. So it's very, very talented, but they lost a lot. They lost, you know, NFL draft picks in Terrion Arnold, Kool-Aid McKinstry, and there's less depth in the secondary for Alabama right now than we've seen in quite a while. Now, that being said, the last week or so, and had I been able to do Good Morning College Football on the Campus to Canton YouTube channel on our normal schedule instead of working on team profiles, I would have talked a little bit about how there was kind of a real bump in starters, defensive back starters entering the transfer portal late in the last cycle. And Alabama was connected to all of them. Mm-hmm. Like immediately they added a starter from Charlotte. They added
the Wake Forest
a starter from
well.
Wake Forest. Yep. So they're already, you know, building some depth from that group. And that's potentially going to pay off. So Alabama is going to, you know, potentially add to this, you know, that big negative nine that's on the screen might get up to like a negative 8.5 or, you know, it might improve just a little bit. There's a little bit of a concern, especially on the back end of the defense, because they're bringing in guys who aren't, you know, were not considered those elite talents coming out of high school. They're having to rely on, like you said, a Wake Forest transfer, a Charlotte transfer. They're connected to some other players, you know, who were group of five players. And that's just, we're not really used to seeing that at Alabama, except they've had to do that the last couple of years. So, what does it mean, you know, in the grand scheme? This is still one of the most talented defenses in the country, but it is not nearly as you know, good on paper as the unit that finished last season. As you said, over 100. We made the decision a couple of years ago we did have a cap at 100 in player ratings for a long time, but one of the areas where we could improve was on the extreme high end. And, you know, some guys just had enough production that they were able to, if there weren't a cap, really just prove they were among the best of the best of the best. And Alabama had a lot of those guys last year. So average player rating over 100 on that defensive side of the ball was about as good as it gets.
Yeah, it was just absolutely insane what Alabama had. I mean, just look at the NFL draft picks they had this year. Guys like Dallas Turner, Kool-Aid McKinstry, Terrion Arnold. Like, that's where the concern in the secondary comes, because you lose those guys, and who do you replace them with? I think the other thing that we have to kind of consider with Alabama is, for the first time in 17 years, we have a different coaching staff there. And that we don't really know how well that they are going to develop, right? I mean, I can assume that they're going to develop well. I mean, Bama's not exactly going to sit there, and especially with Nick Saban still being involved somewhat, like, they're not going to let, you know, this go to the crapper or anything like that. But, you know, it is still a new staff there. Like, for 10 plus years, you just knew Saban knew how to develop DBs. He knew how to develop a defense, right? Obviously, again, Alabama made a really good hire hiring the head coach out of South Alabama, whose name escapes me off the top of my head. Kane Womack. Hiring Kane Womack out of South Alabama. So clearly, again, went out and got a really good hire there. But something to kind of keep in mind here. I'm looking at Alabama's schedule here, especially when you talk about the concerns on the back end there. They face Georgia, which is, again, a team that's going to throw the ball a ton, especially if it is a close game versus Alabama. Tennessee, they go to Tennessee. You know Josh Heupel is going to want to throw the ball on them. Missouri, they got Luther Burden. You know they're going to want to throw on them. LSU, we know for a fact they're going to want to throw. Oklahoma with Jackson Arnold. I'm saying more probably this year than previous years, there's shootout potential with Alabama, especially if they don't figure out that back end.
Well, you kind of jumped a little bit too. I know we're not necessarily expecting that any of these teams are going to beat Alabama those first 3 weeks, but Western Kentucky,
South Florida,
USF, and then Wisconsin. I mean,
yeah, you know,
this time last year we were talking a lot about, oh, the dairy raid, right? It didn't actually work out all that well, but maybe they take a step forward in year two and Alabama has to go to Madison. So, I mean, that's when you've got a rebuilt secondary and a lot of new faces and not a lot of depth. That's kind of a sneaky, tough first three opponents for Alabama.
No, for sure. Again, you're right. I did kind of skip over it and everything, but I didn't want to sound crazy coming off being here. I'm like, well, West
don't worry. I'll do it for you. No
perfect.
Problem.
I appreciate it, Nick. All right, let's move on from Alabama. Let's go look at Texas Tech here. This is a team that I think is kind of the perfect idea of what I'm kind of looking at here with these changes in defenses, right? Texas Tech last year, 2023 defensive roster strength rating, 91.51. That's a really solid defensive roster strength rating, especially for a Big 12 school there. They lose quite a bit. They are moving down to 84.73, a drop of 6.78. That is a big enough drop and pretty much a good enough tier break between that 91 to 94 to where I do think that that is going to be enough to probably, again, my theory on paper, earn Texas Tech those additional scoring opportunities, right? They're going to need to score a little bit more than they had in last year. And in addition, Texas Tech won't be able to just rely on Taj Brooks as much to salt away games if they're having to score more. They're going to have to go back to the Zach Kittley system a little bit, at least just on paper from this theory, of passing the ball a little bit more. Again, this basically, again, my theory is defense gets worse is going to impact how this offense is run compared to last year. So, Nick, you got a big smile on your face. How do you kind of see this playing out with Texas Tech this year? Do you think the defense affects the offense? What do you think?
Well, see, it's funny because I didn't intend to come in and be devil's advocate in this.
No, I like it. This is great. This is good
period.
Discussion.
But as you're saying, like, yeah, you know, I'm thinking because the defense is going to be worse and they're going to throw it and they're going to, you know, score more. And then I'm thinking, well, I don't know if they look over at that defense and say, man, we're not as good as we were last year. Maybe we should slow it down a little on offense. Maybe we should feed Taj Brooks a little bit, make sure our defense, you know, gets plenty of time to rest and gets a breather here or there. So it's, you can, I'm good at talking myself into both things and talking myself in circles. So that was just naturally where I went. But this Texas Tech defense and whether it was because they did lean on Brooks a little bit more than we expected last year, that whether it was because the defense was good or because, you know, maybe they were more well-rested than we expected. They were pretty good defense last season. I mean, they were top 50 in defensive team performance overall. They were top 40 against the pass. They struggled a little bit defending the run, and, you know, the defensive line is the area where they've got the most turnover. So, you know, if you're looking strength of schedule wise and you're, you know, looking early at who's, is there's going to be somebody who's going to be able to take advantage of an inexperienced front, you know, seven or really front three, at least in a team that struggled a little bit against the run last season. The non-conference games or non-conference schedule doesn't look super great, but they've got Cincinnati right there in week five. So maybe that's a good matchup. But anyway, regardless, Texas Tech is it's interesting because we've seen this coaching staff in the past, I was more guilty of it than anyone of getting sucked into, oh, this, Zach Kittley's coming in. This is going to be the greatest passing offense we've ever seen, and Tyler Shuck and all these receivers and da da da. And they're all gone. And what we saw last year just wasn't that, right? So, I don't know. I'm not sure that that I'm able to fully get on board with we're going to see a dramatic change one way or the other based on the defense for Texas Tech. I do think that this Texas Tech defense is going to be a little bit worse. So if you are hopeful that that the Texas Tech offense is going to be able to take a step forward as a result, then yeah, I can get on board with that. Maybe they'll have a little bit more, an extra drive a game or something like that, just because teams are more likely to score or something like that. But also, maybe they don't, because maybe they were getting extra drive per game last year because they were getting a stop on third down, when this year, that team gets another first down and then gets another first down and takes, 2, 3, 4 minutes off the clock. So it's hard for me to say that this one is going to, we're going to see a major impact.
No, I think again, I love the way your mind works, Nick. Again, I can see I can see almost the courtroom in your mind as you're going back and forth between the different ways you can look at it. So let me ask you, Nick, again, Taj Brooks, RB8 and ADP, middle of the second round typically is where he goes. Again, 204 is where he kind of averages out. Are you okay with that value?
I think so, actually. I think I've come on board that one, is Baron Morton healthy?
It's a really good question.
And if he's not, what does that mean? Are you going to just say, hey, we've got Taj Brooks, let's ride him a little bit. They brought in three transfers on the offensive line that started double digit games last year. I have only one full-time starter from last year's offensive line coming back. So, in terms of just overall continuity from last year's team, not great, but as far as overall experience goes, pretty good offensive line. It worked last season. I mean, Brooks, 1500 yard rusher, double digit touchdowns on the ground. Why not? He came back. Hey, let's ride it out. And if I'm thinking like Zach Kittley, yeah, man, I want to throw the football. I've wanted to throw the football forever. Had so much success at WKU. But you know what? More than I like throwing the football, I like winning football games. And Taj Brooks is our best player. And I don't know if I've got a healthy quarterback. Maybe I should just give the ball to Taj Brooks 20, 25, 30 times a game.
Potentially. Again, I just don't really see how he gets back to that 300 touches that he got again last year. Again, his volume was just absolutely insane towards the end of the season. You have to imagine that he'll probably get a little bit of a bounce or kind of drawn back from that a little bit, especially again, like if Baron
Potentially.
Morton's healthy,
Yeah.
like he's going to want to throw the football. The one thing that Kittley has not had since he's gotten to Texas Tech is a healthy quarterback at any given point. Really, or at least one that he can continuously work with. Because again, as much as throwing Drake Strong out there for a game or two is nice, like that's not his long-term goal. Again, he liked Baron Moore and he kept him around, but again, he's had his own health issues, so we'll see. Last team we'll talk about here, Nick, is again G5 team, Toledo. I did not realize it was possible for a MAC school to have a defensive roster strength rating of 91.26, but dadgummit, did Toledo have that last year? Well, now they're coming back to the pack a little bit this year. 2024 defensive roster strength rating here of 84.59. Still a pretty good one in terms of, MAC, or compared to the rest of the MAC. Again, a drop of 6.67 here. But again, same kind of question with Texas Tech here, Nick. This is a pretty decent tier drop, especially for a team that, again, that's a really, really good defensive rating they had last year. They could take advantage of that in the MAC. Is that going to impact the type of games that Toledo is going to play and, again, potentially force them to score a little bit more this year?
Well, that Toledo defense had a first round draft pick on it, didn't
Yes,
it?
sir.
So, and they
One
were,
that Bama tried to poach.
there you go. So, it was a talented group, and Quinion Mitchell wasn't the only good player. They had some transfers from Ohio State, among other places, come in. They had guys who were there for a long time, just were able to grow, develop, and there was a lot of continuity the last few years on that defensive side of the ball. And Toledo won a lot of games the last couple of years. So most of that unit is moving on. Toledo ranks 104th in our defensive returning production, adjusted for transfers. And I'm glad you mentioned Toledo because I do think there's a little bit of an impact there. I have no idea necessarily who's going to benefit just because the offense, I don't really know what
Well, the
how things
offense loses
are
a
really
ton
going to
as
come
well,
together.
right?
Exactly. But bigger picture for me, as I was going through and doing all these team profiles and roster updates and things like that, man, the MAC on paper looks bad.
It's
I mean,
bad.
just really, really bad. And so sometimes I think we paint with too broad a brush of, oh, these defenses are bad, so they're going to be a lot of high scoring. We've seen some pretty ugly low scoring games in the MAC in recent years, and some of that is because there have been some defenses like Toledo who've been very, very good, very talented. So this year, there, at least as it looks right now to me on paper, there really aren't very good teams at all in the MAC. And so I don't know. Will that mean we get back to those high scoring games because these guys are just bad and can't tackle and can't cover and whatever? Maybe. Or are these offenses just as bad because that
Yep.
seems to be kind of the case too, and there's just going to be a lot of sloppy football, one way or the other. So, this one, I really don't have much to say other than I think as a whole, the MAC might just be really bad. And so, will that be fun and exciting bad, or will that just be ooh, ugly? Don't want to, nobody's any good, and so nobody's putting up good numbers, offense or defense. I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet, but it was striking to me as I was going through teams like Ball State, teams like Buffalo, just some of the worst rosters in my experience building these team profiles. And maybe it's just because, the next great star hasn't got that opportunity yet. But also maybe it's just these teams just aren't able to replenish the guys that they lose through the transfer portal or players moving on to graduation and some of them to the NFL. They're just not able to replenish them quite as well as maybe they were in the past just because some of the changes in college football. But whatever it is, man, these MAC teams don't look good just as a whole.
Yeah, no. My point I was going to bring up is the fact that the MAC more than any other conference I think has been just completely victimized by the transfer portal. Like the moment somebody pops off in the MAC, you're not even talking about like the big boys like Bama or Ohio State coming in and poaching the top players or anything like that. The MAC schools can't compete NIL wise with the Indianas of the world. They can't compete with the Utahs. They can't compete with the Kansases of, well, I mean, Kansas got a pretty decent NIL program, I imagine, for the basketball program. But you guys get my point, right? Like, these are like low-level Power 5 schools. Heck, they're G5 schools. You got Sun Belt teams coming in and just completely outbidding MAC players from the MAC. And again, the MAC has just gotten completely decimated. Now it's creating this almost perfect storm for one of two extremes to happen, as Nick kind of pointed out. Either everything's bad, there's just sloppy football being played all over the place. You get low scoring games because nobody can put together a cohesive offensive game plan or defensive game plan, and you're just watching a bunch of chickens run around with their heads cut off on the field. But in that environment, the stars are going to shine even brighter, right? When along comes a dude that just chooses, he's an athletic freak, chooses a MAC school, they go out there and they're just dominating the competition, they're gonna get even more targets than what you would see. Like, I think Christian McCray last
Are
year.
you talking about Harold Fannin? Is this a
Harold Fannin
Harold
is a
Fannin
perfect.
soliloquy?
This is a Harold Fannin, but I'm also thinking like Christian McCay, right? Christian McCay before he got hurt last year was just seen an absurd number of targets from the Kent State offense. Because again, he's the only thing that works. And that's just what's going to happen moving forward in the MAC. When you got running backs that, again, when they're the only player on your team that seems worth anything, that's the perfect storm to just have a dude be fed 30 times because he can just out-athlete the rest of the defenses. It's just even more so than what we've seen in the past. Because like you said, Nick, the overall quality of the players around them, both on their own offenses and the defenses they're facing, is getting lower and lower in the MAC each year. So it's definitely fun. Now, how does this, again, going back to Toledo, we're on like a whole MAC just in general rant here. But in terms of Toledo here, again, Tucker Gleason, Jacquez Stewart, again, on paper, I like the fact that Toledo is probably going to have to score more a little bit, but I can't really go as far to say, like, oh, this is going to bump up Tucker Gleason in my rankings or, you know, Jacquez Stewart. Because, again, there's just too many questions outside of, you know, how much is Toledo going to have to be able to score, considering that, as you mentioned, Nick, like, I'm curious, like, what's Toledo's offensive returning production? Like, how do they rank compared to the rest? I don't know if you have that number. Ready to go, because like it's dealing with the same problem.
126th.
Oh, so yeah, they're bottom seven in the country. So
they lost Daquan Finn out of the transfer portal, as you mentioned. Yep. Penny Boone, of course. There's some experience and depth at the receiver position and tight end, but the offensive line is you know, they have zero returning career starts on the offensive
line. Oh my god! No.
You know, so it's not great. What I'm thinking as far as, I mean, they're still number one in our MAC power rankings.
Holy crap.
Just because, you know, they're just more talented. They do recruit at a higher level than just about anybody else in the MAC and, you know, do have some transfers here and there. I said zero career starts. They do have an offensive lineman transfer coming in who has started at Prairie View A&M in the SWAC, Alan Jones. But
that'll be a game changer.
Yeah, well, he's the most experienced guy they got on the offensive line. Mostly, and I haven't yet, and I know it's May, and I probably shouldn't admit this on this podcast in particular, I still haven't turned on my CFF, you know, brain at all yet. Maybe now that the team profiles are out in the world, I will be. But my thought in this whole conversation is like, okay, well, who, if the MAC is so bad, who is good? You know, who can take advantage? And is it Ontario Brown at Northern Illinois? You know, is it who's an actual good player that's just going to be a man amongst boys? And maybe it is Brown, but at least, you know, actually with him at Northern Illinois, they've got a little depth behind them. They added Gavin Williams and Kendrell Flowers. And so maybe he even is, you know, not going to get as heavy of a workload as you might like, but probably break off plenty of 50-yard touchdowns. So anyway, that I think is my MAC strategy, is going to be going through and trying to figure out, okay, who's actually good and who's going to be able to take advantage of just everybody else being bad.
Yeah, I'd have to take a look at previous year's ADP, but I'm just like looking through the top ADP for this year and everything, and it is kind of striking just how little MAC players there are compared to previous years. Like, again, just off the top of my head, again, you mentioned Ontario Brown, but like, who's next, right? Like Ricky White out of Ohio. Like, I'm probably forgetting
Buckley, right?
Jalen Buckley, I'm kind of off of a little bit because I really don't like that offensive coordinator hire they made over there. But like at receiver,
but they, I mean, Western Michigan, you know, if you look at offensive line, it's not terrible.
Not terrible is the best we can get in the MAC right now.
You know, maybe.
But yep, that pretty much does it for our show today. Nick, again, I appreciate you coming on today and being flexible with me and everything. Again, you've just released the team profiles. Are you taking a break, or are you getting, what are you gearing up for next? What's next in the world of Nicholas Ian Allen?
Well, so I have a non football obligation that is going to put me out of the office until Monday, which by the time you're hearing this, I'll be back. So that's why we went ahead and not necessarily rush the team profiles, but if I really wanted to, I probably would have held it a week or more just to polish it just a little bit more. I think we said this before we started recording, but today, putting this out in the world is the worst version of it. It will get better. There are some things that we're going to continue to improve. But had I held it instead of 1 week, it would have been 2 weeks because I'm going to be, like I said, out the next 4 or 5 days. So we'll do some, transfer updates and things like that if something comes along, something I can do real quick. But really, really, finalizing. There's a couple of dozen G5 teams that their defensive depth charts I need to get fully updated, things like that. Get in some snap percentages and snaps per game for those teams and things like that. So there's still some areas where it's not 100%. What I would most want it to be, that over the next couple of weeks, once I get back in the office, have to clean up some of those things. And then next thing on the to-do list is stat projection. So
Yep.
that actually will be a little bit more of a CFF focused activity, sort of my first one of the year. Going to get together our season-long stats, and then I have a plan. I think to break it out so we do a little bit better job of weekly projections. So I'm not having to recreate that each week. It'll kind of be done on the front end with just some minor tweaks each week instead of an hours long process. So hopefully those will be able to be put out earlier in each week on the Campus to Canton Discord. Last year, I think it was by the end of the day, Tuesday. Hopefully, with some of the changes I want to implement, some of the updates, we'll be able to get those out, Monday as soon as possible. So next big thing, stat projections. I don't take any time off other than this week.
No,
So
never.
no rest.
Also, incorrect on the this will be your first CFF activity of the year, Nick. You always participate in my way too early CFF
Oh,
mock
see,
draft.
that was just a carryover from the previous year, and I basically just went, okay, who's coming back and who's the highest rated player? So that wasn't it. That was mostly autopilot. That wasn't even so. But you're right. You're right.
It sounds like I
But
need it sounds like I need to add you to the
just between
next.
you and me, I was going to say just between you and me. That's the only CFF draft I've done this year. So
Well,
yeah, maybe.
it sounds like I need to just add you to the next best ball group chat that I get kick started, and we're gonna force you into it, Nick. That
We'll
brings
see.
us, yeah, we'll see. You say that as if you have a choice right now, Nick. With all that being said, appreciate all of you guys listening, but we have come to the end of our show. Thank you guys all for listening. If you have not already, go ahead and leave a like, comment, and subscribe if you're watching this on the YouTube side of things. If you're on the podcast side of things, make sure you follow that show. Leave the 5-star reviews wherever you can. Make sure you guys check out the rest of the Campus Canton Podcast Network for shows ranging on pretty much anything you can think of related to the college fantasy game, including Nick's CFB Winning Edge show. We'll see you guys back here next Monday. Until then, really appreciate you guys, and I hope you have a wonderful and blessed week. See y'all.